I'm reading from Matthew 16, 21 to 28. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." And Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world, yet forfeits his soul? What can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he has done. I tell you the truth. Some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom."
Thank you, Francis. You know, when you don't preach often or regularly, what I find is that this could go one of two ways. We could be here a while, or we could be here just a real short while. Amen, yeah. Mark Twain, I think, once said that if you want me to speak for 20 minutes, it's going to take me a week to prepare, but if you want me to speak for an hour, I'm ready now. So that song that we just sang, "It Is Well," is it well? Is it well with you? And you don't need to answer, but I would encourage you to be honest anyway. Because I can tell you, over the last month or so, I just feel this unease about, not about me, not about my life, not about my family, but in some ways about what the world's become. Just watching the news and the chaos and the unrest and all of that, and I had to remind myself this last week that really unrest is not new for us, particularly as Americans. We kind of started out, even before we were a country, with a riot in Boston where a lot of property was destroyed by being dumped in the harbor. And we've had periods where we've had civil unrest or different kinds of unrest in our country. As Christians, we, in as Baptists, come under kind of an umbrella known as Protestants, and Protestants were those that protested abuses that were taking place in the Catholic Church of their day. And if you read church history, you'll discover that the protests weren't just with fiery sermons, but there are those in Baptist life who believe that we as Baptists descend probably more from a strain called Anabaptists than Protestants, although it's somewhat all rolled up into one ball. But you could read stories about those Anabaptists who were opposed by other Christians, and to the extent that I remember reading a story that in one place they rounded up all these Anabaptists, and these were Christians that were rounding them up. It wasn't just some atheistic state. They were other Christians who were rounding them up who just disagreed with them doctrinally, and they put them all into a boat, drilled a hole in the bottom of the boat, tied their hands behind their backs, and just set them out to sea. Where they would eventually just sink and drown. So unrest and unease and all of that is seems like it's a part of life. It's just not a part that I'm used to, and it's not a part that I want to get used to. And so I ask myself a lot, how do I navigate through all of this? And recently I really have had a sense that I don't find comfort in Twitter, and I don't find comfort in Facebook, and I don't find comfort on the evening news, and I don't find hope in any of those places. I don't find hope in a lot of the discussions that are taking place in our world because they're just so polarized. And so I find hope in the Word of God. And I've had to turn a lot of that other stuff off and just dive deeper into that. And it's there that I find that God puts the world right. Righteousness, the word righteousness that we find in the Bible, is a word that's about God taking what's wrong and making it right. And that was Jesus' mission in the world, was to enter into the world, a world that was broken and defeated and racked by chaos and sin, and to make it right. I remember reading many years ago a book by Dallas Willard, The Divine Conspiracy, and toward the beginning of that book, he uses this illustration, and he says that we're flying through life like we're flying in a fighter plane. But as we naturally fly through life, what we don't realize is that we're flying upside down. And normally, if you're flying right side up and you want to ascend, you want to go up, you want things to move in an upward direction, you pull up on the stick. But if you're flying upside down and you pull up on the stick, you end up crashing. And life apart from what Jesus entered the world to do is like flying upside down and pulling up on the stick. And there are just a lot of crashes that we see. And Israel was no stranger to those kind of crashes. And many of those crashes were based on their expectations of what life would be like, what God was doing in the world, what their place in that was, and how they participate in attaining that place that God had for them. And that's really at the heart of what's going on here in this discussion with Jesus and Peter. And it's not that Peter gets everything wrong, because in the passage right before this one, Jesus has his disciples around him, and he asks them, you know, I hear a lot about what people think about me. Who are people saying that I am? And so the disciples chime in, and well, some think that you're a prophet, some think that you're Elijah come back, some think that you're John the Baptist back from the dead. There are all kinds of ideas about who you are, and Jesus said, well, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And Peter makes this really profound statement that I imagine most of us in here and even online are familiar with. He says, you are the Christ, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, blessed are you, Peter, because God has revealed this to you. You didn't come up with this on your own, but God has revealed this to you. And then he has this blessing that he gives. He talks about the church, the prevailing of the church, the assembled people of God, that the gates of hell itself will not prevail against God's work in the world. But then right after that, we have this passage that Francis read for us this morning, where Peter's now getting it, it seems, all wrong. In fact, he gets it so wrong that one of the strongest rebukes that we find in all of the Bible is spoken by Jesus, right on the heels of him saying, "Blessed are you, Peter." Then he turns around 6 verses later and says, "Get behind me, Satan." And that's quite the contrast. Quite the contrast. So what did Peter get wrong? What was it that he wasn't understanding? Well, Jesus had said at the beginning of this passage that he was going to have to go to Jerusalem, and while he was there, he would suffer many things. He would suffer at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, that he would be mocked and abused, that he would be killed. And Peter grabs Jesus and he takes him aside and he starts to scold him. "Oh, no. This isn't going to happen." Why would Peter do that? Did he just think that all of a sudden Jesus is no longer the Messiah, or that Jesus doesn't know what he's talking about? Why would Peter pull Jesus aside and say, "No, that's not going to happen. Suffering, mocking, death is not going to happen for you"? No. It's not just because his hope was that something different would happen. It's because his expectation was different than that. You see, Peter, along with really any typical Jew of that day, had certain expectations of what the Messiah would be and what the Messiah would do when he came. And we can really even look back on Israel's history and we can see what those expectations were. We don't have to make it up. We see some of it in the Gospels themselves, where Jesus is asked, "Lord, when are you going to bring your kingdom in?" Because they looked around them and, you know, feeding 5,000 and healing people and even raising Lazarus from the dead, to them, I mean, those are signs of the kingdom coming, but that's not the kingdom. So when is the actual kingdom going to come? Because they could look at all of that and say, "Well, maybe that looks kind of like it, but that's not the kingdom." We look back at a period between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and there was a time when there was a family that rose up that was leading Israel. And at that time, the Syrians were in charge of Israel. They were like the nation over Israel. And there was this guy named Antiochus, who was the leader or the ruler of Syria. And he pretty much thought that, well, you know, live and let live as far as the Jews go. But then his son came to power. He died. His son came to power. He was called Antiochus Epiphanes, or he was the fourth. His dad was the third. And he didn't have a live and let live attitude toward Israel. He sent troops into Jerusalem to ransack the temple and then defile it. And the way that they defiled the temple was to sacrifice pigs on the altar. And of course, pigs for a Jew were unclean. And so to sacrifice an unclean animal would have defiled their worship, would have defiled the temple, they would have had to go through an entire process of kind of reclaiming it and making all that right. But for a long time, they couldn't. And so this family that was kind of in charge in Israel, there was a son, and his name was Judah, and he had a nickname called the Hammer, Judah Maccabees. And Maccabees just meant the hammer. And so Judah gathered around him a number of rebels who went in and drove the Syrians out, and they went into a process of restoring and cleansing the temple. And there was actually kind of a myth that arose about how that happened. It said that when they went into the temple to start their work to restore it, that they only had enough oil to light the lamps for one day, but somehow, miraculously, the oil lasted for 8 days. Jesus, in the Gospels, made reference to this event because Israel created a celebration around it. They created a holiday around it called the Feast of Lights. And the lights were because the menorahs, the candles, were lit while they were restoring the temple. And then this, whether it was true or not, I don't know. The Bible doesn't speak to it, but whether it's true that oil lasted for 8 days when they only had a day's worth, I don't know. But to this day, here in a couple of months, when we celebrate Christmas, the Jews are going to celebrate that Festival of Lights again. It's called Hanukkah for them. So for 2,000, really more than 2,000 years, they've been celebrating that event. But it was Judah who gathered up rebels who went into that temple and drove the Syrians out, and they thought at that time that he might be the Messiah. Problem was, it didn't last very long, because all it did was inflame the Syrians to come back in and defeat them all and kill them all. There would be a time after Jesus also where something very similar would happen. In 70 AD, the temple was destroyed again, this time by the Romans. But it was all because of unrest that was taking place in Israel. Jesus was crucified because of unrest that was taking place in Israel. Israel was, in the Roman Empire, Israel was a place that was known as a hot spot. It seemed like there was always trouble there. There was always somebody who was rising up, claiming to be the deliverer of Israel, who would throw off the oppressors. And at the time, Rome was the empire of the day. And so, if there are people and there are rumblings about the Jews forming an uprising, then they need to take care of that. And so they put a guy in charge during Jesus' time named Pilate. And they didn't put Pilate in charge because he was all that gifted of a leader. They actually put him in charge probably as a last chance for him. They likely didn't think much of him or his abilities. And so they sent him and said, "You'll be the governor over Israel, and your job is to make sure that you maintain peace." And if he didn't maintain peace, it wasn't just that he would be fired. He would likely be executed. That gives us a little context then when Jesus, here shortly after this passage we read in Matthew 16, Jesus goes to Jerusalem, and all of a sudden, what happens there? Well, we have Palm Sunday, and everything seems to be great, but within a week, what's going on? There are literally riots going on in the streets. Shouting, demanding that Jesus be crucified. Now, Pilate's in a bit of a pickle because there's not any Roman law that Jesus has broken that deserves capital punishment, but what do you do? I mean, if I don't do something about this uprising, if I don't do something about this rioting, if I don't do something about this rebellion, then I'm not just looking at losing my job. I'm looking at losing my life, potentially. And so he does the thing that saves his own neck. And it results in the death of Jesus. And then we see these disciples walking the road to Emmaus along with Jesus, and they're downcast and they're distraught because they thought that Jesus would be the Messiah. But the problem is, Messiahs don't suffer. Messiahs don't die on crosses. Instead, what Messiahs do is Messiahs liberate Israel. They restore the kingdom when James and John were arguing over who was going to sit at Jesus' right hand and his left hand when he came into the kingdom, that wasn't them just getting big heads. That was them trying to figure out in their minds how their expectations would actually play out in real life. They expected a Messiah who would liberate them, who would throw off Rome. And that's what Peter expected. So when Jesus starts talking about suffering and dying, the natural thing is for him to pull Jesus aside and say, "What are you talking about? That's not how this works. That's not how a Messiah ascends to David's throne." All he's doing is expressing his expectations of how God works in the world. The problem was his expectations of how God works and how God was working were two different things. And so Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." It's almost a callback to Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. Because it's not that there's not coming a day. I mean, the book of Revelation tells us there's coming a day when the kingdoms of this world will become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. So that day is coming. That day just wasn't this day. And when Jesus was in that wilderness being tempted of the devil, those things that the devil was tempting him with were not particularly bad things. The devil didn't come to Jesus and say, "Hey, I got a little crack over here. You want to try some?" He wasn't saying, "You know, there's a little prostitute over here. What do you think? She's kind of cute, huh?" He wasn't tempting Jesus with things that we would normally evaluate as blatantly sinful. Instead, he's tempting him with good things. Jesus has been in the wilderness for 40 days and has not eaten. And he tests him and says, "Take this stone and turn it into bread. Eat." Bread would have been good for him. He takes him up onto a mountain and he shows him the kingdoms of the world and says, "All of this can be yours." Guess what? All of that already was his. All of that was already promised to him. The temptation was to take it a different way than the plan that God had in mind. Instead of finding bread the way that God would nourish him, in fact, it tells us that after the devil left him in that temptation in the wilderness, what happened? Angels came and attended to him. He got that bread. He got what he needed. But he got it God's way and not the devil's way. Not that I've forgotten what I'm going to say. It's that I want to be measured in how I say it. I look around me at the world today, and what I see is I see far too many of us, and I'm talking about us in the church. I'm not talking about the world. The world is going to do what the world's going to do. If they're lost people, if they're estranged from God, then they're going to act like people who are estranged from God. And the expectation that they're going to act differently is really an unrealistic expectation for us. I mean, lost people are going to do what lost people do. Redeemed people ought to do what redeemed people were meant to do. And that means that we don't use those same tactics and those same arguments and those same mindsets that we find in the world around us. And I tell you, I'm about to delete Facebook. If it weren't for the fact that it's a way that I keep up with people that I've known for a lot of my life, one thing I am finding real handy is that there's a function on there to either mute somebody for 30 days, and invariably when I mute them for 30 days, I go scrolling through Facebook and I'm like, oh, mute must be off. We must have passed 30 days because here comes the crazy again. But there's also a way that you can just, you unfollow them, I think it is. You remain friends, you just don't see their stuff anymore. And there are people that recently I've just started unfollowing because I don't need to see that anymore. I don't need to see the arguing, and I don't need to see the polarization, and I don't need to see the bickering that, oh, the Democrats are going to save us. We've got to get rid of Trump at all costs, or Trump is going to save us because the Democrats are going to drive us into communism and socialism. I don't care about any of that. I mean, I do care about our country, and I care about its direction, and I do believe that the Word of God speaks to it, and I believe theology is political, but I just don't believe that the tactics, the way that we go about promoting God's kingdom in the world is the same that I see from every other corner of our culture. But too much of what I see is that we just play by the same rules. We think that the way that God's kingdom is going to come is if we somehow elect the right people into office and get them to do the things that we want them to do. Do you know how many times in the Bible that ever happened? Do you even know how many times in the Bible the person that Israel wanted to lead them was the one who actually led them? Almost never. Almost never. Even when they got the one guy that they wanted, who was the one guy at the very beginning when Israel became a kingdom and had their first king, they wanted one guy. And how did that turn out? What kind of a king was Saul? I mean, normally kingdoms are dynasties, and Saul's throne would have been passed on to one of his children, but that didn't even happen because it was such a disaster. And you know why? Because when Israel asked for a king, they said, God, we want a king like all the other nations have. And so you know what God gave them? A king that was just like all the other nations have. I'm just going to tell you, there's not a politician that's going to save you. There's not a politician that is going to accomplish for you and give you the kind of life that you want. It will not happen. If it does, it will be so short-lived that you won't even be able to remember it. In another place, Dallas Willard, who happened to be a philosopher, he was also a Baptist minister. He taught philosophy at USC in California for a number of years, but I remember reading an article by him one time, and he said, you know, if you look just kind of philosophically at the questions people ask, regardless of their culture, regardless of their time, and all of that, people tend to ask the same three questions. If you're a human being and you're living in China under a communist rule, or if you're an American living in Oklahoma under democratic rule, or if you are living somewhere under a tyrant in the world, people tend to ask the same three questions. Who am I? What is a good life? And how can I have it? And it just so happens that those three questions also seem to be prominent themes that we find in the Bible. Who am I? Well, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and all that was in them. So we are the creation of God. That, at its base, is who we are. And then it talks about the creation of human beings and that we were made in the image of God. So we're God's image bearers as well. And we can jump to the New Testament, to John 1, where John is imitating Genesis 1 when he says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelled among us, full of grace and truth." And then later on says, that as many as believed on him, to him he gave the right to be called the children of God. Who are we? Well, we're children of God. We're God's image bearers. We're his creation. What's a good life? Jesus said, I've come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. How can I have it? Believe on the Lord Jesus and you will be saved. If you'll confess with your mouth and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. I mean, the Bible deals with these questions. Who am I? What's a good life? How can I have it? And if all that's true, and if the Bible gives us answers to those questions, one of the things that we find is that very often the answers to some of those questions are different than our expectations. I think there are still many of us today who our expectation is that the Republicans are going to save us, or the Democrats are going to save us, or the power brokers are going to save us, or the wealthy are going to save us, or the connected are going to save us. And so if we can just get ourselves connected with those people, if we can get in, if we can get a seat at the table with the power brokers or the politicians or the wealthy or whoever, they'll be the ones who have the resources to make it right. But you know what? God is the God who owns the cattle on a thousand hills. He has all the resources that are needed. And the key really is this, is that God almost never, if you read through the Bible, God almost never accomplishes his purposes through the rich and powerful. But he almost always accomplishes his purpose through those who are nobodies and nothings. Moses wasn't anyone prominent when God pulled him out of the Nile River. David was a shepherd tending his fields who, even when he went out to take sandwiches to his brothers on the battlefield, was laughed at and told to go home. He was no one prominent. The disciples in the book of Acts, they're actually called idiots by the religious leaders of the day. We translators tone it down and translate it, they were unlearned. But the Greek word is idiotai, which is the word we get idiot from. He's always using the least likely people and the least likely means to accomplish his purpose. And so how is it that Jesus can accomplish his purpose by going to Jerusalem and suffering and dying? Well, do you know what we don't have if we don't have the death of Jesus on that cross? We don't have the resurrection. And you know what happened in that resurrection? That was, so Jesus is basically saying, listen, you think that the way to do this is to avoid death and to gain power and to sit on a throne and rule somewhere. What I'm going to show you is that the way of God is to go into Jerusalem, to walk down those streets and be mocked and ridiculed in the middle of unrest and a riot, to be hung on a cross and to die, so that 3 days later, we can all look around and say, oh, death, you just thought you won, but you didn't, because I have risen from the dead. Peter wanted Jesus to accomplish his purposes through force, through an alliance with power, through the normal ways that we think God should work in the world, but that's not how God typically does work in the world. All right, I'm about done. I don't even know what time it is. Okay. It's not lunchtime yet, is it? No. Seriously, I'm just about done, so hang with me just another minute. It wasn't in spite of the cross that Jesus accomplished God's purposes. It was because of the cross that Jesus accomplished. It was through the cross that Jesus accomplished his purposes. And I remember reading, I think it was a commentary on Romans by a theologian. He was just talking about Paul's theology in general, kind of how Paul looked at the world as he wrote the books that he wrote in the New Testament, or the letters that he wrote. And N.T. Wright said that Paul had it in his mind that if suffering and death was the way that God would accomplish his purposes through Jesus, that if it was good enough for Jesus, that it was also good enough for Paul. And so we find Paul in a place like Romans, or not Romans, in Philippians 3, where he says that really he's got all these things that he could brag about, but he says, I'm not going to brag about any of those things because I consider them as nothing. I consider them as purpose. Him, the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings. Because, hey, in the world today, if it's through suffering, then let me suffer. Purposes may prevail. Fight the right, at least oppose them, flame them from our keyboards. Which is fine. I'm not saying that it's good that we've got rioting going on. One of the things I am saying is that our world has had a history of that going back since before Jesus' time. And if our expectation is that we're going to put an end to it, then we're probably whistling in the wind because it's not likely to happen. But really, the way forward for us is to follow the way of Jesus. It's to walk down that road what does Jesus say there in the last half of this passage that Francis read for us this morning? He said, if anyone wants to come after me, let him deny himself. In other words, it's not all about me. It's not all about what I want. It's not all about what I think should happen. That's the root of self-denial, is to say it's not about me. Jesus would have never gone to the cross if he had had the attitude that, well, it's all about me. It's all about my self-preservation. It's all about making sure that no harm comes to me. Where would we be if he took that attitude? Well, we would be forever lost in our sin and hopeless in this world. But instead, it wasn't about him. He denied himself, and he calls us to deny ourselves. And he says, take up your cross. What does it mean to take up your cross? Well, it means that when we walk out those doors, we consider ourselves as good as dead. If that comes at the hands of rioters, or if that comes at the hands of the powers that be, whatever, what does it matter if God has us in his hands, if God has us in his care? The genius of the resurrection was that it's not just Jesus who rose from the dead, but one day you and I will too. So, okay, come and take my body. That's not an invitation. It's a resignation. It's saying that if that's what it comes to, okay, but guess what? You won't win because death has already been defeated. It was defeated as soon as Jesus rose from the grave. And then the promise to us is, and this is from 1 Thessalonians, he says that Jesus will come back or 1 Corinthians, I'm sorry, it says that Jesus was the first fruit of the resurrection of the dead. After he returns, then us too. That's how we live forever. Well, I want to read some words. So what's the way forward for us? I want to read some words. This is kind of a companion passage for us that comes from Paul's letter to the Romans in chapter 12. How do we go about, what does it mean, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me? Well, I think the Apostle Paul gives us a pretty good description of what that looks like. Think about this. As I read these words, I want you to think about what would our community What would our conversations, what would our world look like if the church were to go into the world and do these things, live these things out? Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. I'll pause right there because you know I grew up with two brothers and we fought. I mean, you may not know that, but we did. But I've always kind of looked back at it and after every fight, it's like, well, there's still nothing that will ever happen where he'll quit being my brother, even through the fight. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be constant in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be conceited. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, this is your side of the equation, not anyone else's side, but if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it's written, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Do you want to know how we make a difference in the world? Do you know how we live that question, what's the good life? How can I have it? Well, there you go. We can go out there and we can be keyboard warriors and we can get in online fights and we can make it all about who is or isn't elected or who does and doesn't have the power, who has the resources or who doesn't and all that. God's got all the power. He's got all He's got everything necessary and everything needful for us. And I trust that He's got a plan and that, you know what, it really doesn't. I'm not going to say that we shouldn't care who gets elected. What I am going to say is that it doesn't matter who gets elected in the context of what God will accomplish in His world. Because there's no one who would get elected, who could get elected, who could thwart God's plan. There's no one who could get elected who will keep God from doing what He intends to do in this world. Whether it's the one that you hope with all your heart gets elected or the one that you dread with all your heart might, it doesn't matter. God can and will accomplish His purpose. And the way that we play a part in that is not to come up to Him and say, oh, no, 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 not that way. But instead is to be the people of God as Paul described there in Romans, as Jesus describes here to Peter, when he says, deny yourselves, take up your cross, follow me. If we do that in our world, I'm convinced, and I feel like I've quoted Dallas Willard a lot, but I'll leave with one thing that I recall him saying. He said, if we would do those things, if we lived out life like we see there in Romans 12, that passage that I read, that in all likelihood, we wouldn't be able to keep people out because they would be clamoring to get in. they know how to be keyboard warriors. They know how to fight. They know how to be polarized. They know how to argue for who should win and who should lose and all of that. God's above all that. May our trust be in Him, and may we follow Him in the path that He leads, even if it means that it leads to suffering and a cross, because really it will.